Hello and welcome to What Did I Learn? An eight-part series of short podcasts considering Chapter 11 from the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Professor Carl Quigley. My learning was prompted through membership of the Telegram-based CTTM, Cutting Through the Matrix Book Club. The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim. Nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. Carol Quigley. Tragedy and Hope, Chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns, page 499. Great Britain. Carol Quigley informs us that 19th century Britain was awash with capital, with private savings being the main source of industrial financing, and goes on to point out that corporatization was a slow burn, with industry preferring the benefits of limited liability. And I ask the question, why wouldn't they? He goes on to state that investment banks, etc., were not interested in domestic industrial securities except for railroads. Apparently, for close to 100 years, banks had a marked preference for government bonds, both foreign and domestic. Quigley goes on to point out that 17 private merchant banks were able to find money for established and wealthy enterprises on both a long and a short-term basis. Some of those merchant bankers, whose names no doubt many listeners will be familiar with, are as follows: Baring Brothers, N. M. Rothschild, J. Henry Schroeder, Morgan Grenfell, Ambrose, and Lazard Brothers. The merchant bankers, Quigley notes, had a dominant position within the Bank of England. A key event for Britain and her economy was the Labour government of 1946, who nationalised the Bank of England. Notable within the history of the Bank of England was the appointment of Lord Cromer, a Baring, as governor of the bank, and his subsequent serving of a term extending from 1961 to 1966. His board of directors were known as the Court of the Bank. The Court, needless to say, included establishment insiders as representatives from other banks, such as from Lazard, Ambrose, Morgan Grenfell, and indeed also a presence from the company English Electric. Quigley observes that financial capitalism flourished in Britain from 1920 to 1944, during the governorship of Montague Norman. However, financial capitalism had begun almost 100 years after the advent of industrial capitalism. So, who then was Montague Norman? Well, Montague Norman, 1871-1950, was an English banker whose nickname was the Currency Director of Europe. As one might imagine, he was deeply tied to the English aristocracy. And what then was industrial capitalism? It was the economic system that emerged during the Industrial Revolution and was characterized by the dominance of industrialists over the merchant class and over the shift towards factory production. Quigley observes that industrial capitalism kicked off with the promotion of Guinness Limited, by Barings Bank in 1886. So, what then was promotionism in the context of the banking business? Promotionism could be characterized as the communication of an invitation to engage in investment activity made in the course of business. So, what did the bedding in of financial capitalism in Britain look like? The bedding in, so to speak, took place in the 1890s and was exemplified between 1894 and 1896 by the activities of one E. T. Hooley, who promoted 26 corporations with various noble lords as the directors of each. Who then was E. T. Hooley? Oh dear. Ernest T. Hooley, 1859-1947, is on record as having been an English financial fraudster. Maybe he should have bought himself into the House of Lords under some obscure title like, for example, Lord Corruption. Hooley's corporation's promotion package of the time had a total capital value of £18.6 million, of which Hooley took a mere £5 million, or approximately 26%, for himself. Yep, nice work if you can get it. Quigley notes that although financial capitalism grew rapidly in Britain, it never achieved the heights which it did in the United States, or in Germany for that matter. It seems that foreign countries were the chief areas of exploitation for British financial capitalism, that is, up until the crash of 1931. What then characterized the crash of 1931? It was a European banking crisis, which saw the collapse of several major banks in Austria and in Germany. The fallen were Kreditanstalt on the 11th of May 1931, Landesbank der Rhein Provinz on the 11th of July 1931, and Danat Bank on the 13th of July 1931. Quigley points out that financial capitalism in Britain made little use of holding companies, exercising its influence instead by interlocking directorates and direct financial controls. However, the new kid on the block, monopoly capitalism, raised its ugly head in Britain via the intervention of men like William H. Lever, 1851-1925, and Alfred M. Mond, 1868-1930. Lever created a great international monopoly in vegetable oils via his business Unilever, while Mond created the British chemical monopoly known as Imperial Chemical Industries, ICI. Quigley indicates that a downside of financial capitalism in Britain was manifest in the growth of financial control over industry, and increasing concentration in such control, and also by an increase in banking control over government. He goes on to state that the influence of the Bank of England over government in Britain was an unmitigated disaster. However, banking powers in business was less than it was in government, because British business remained self-financing to a greater extent than in other countries, and the early industrialization in Britain had facilitated the largely self-financing of British industry. However, industrialization elsewhere had eroded Britain's advantage, forcing British business to seek outside financial aid. Quigley notes that financial capitalism grew in Britain in tandem with Britain's capital plant becoming obsolete. He also noted the Bank of England control over business was achieved indirectly through the joint stock banks, which were heading steadily towards less and less in their numbers, but towards more and more of their residual number being in control of British business. The diminishing prevalence of joint stock banks in Britain is exemplified by these numbers. In 1886, there were 109. 33 years later, in 1919, there were only 35. And 14 years later, in 1933, there were just 33. Yeah, I know, an awful lot of 33s there, eh? Next up for Quigley was another form of monopoly, that is, the so-called trust. The growth of a money trust in Britain, that is, meaning financial wealth controlled by a powerful few, prompted an investigation by a Treasury Committee on Bank Amalgamations. The ensuing report in 1919 became known as the Colwyn Report. Subsequent to the Colwyn Report, a government bill was drawn up to prevent further amalgamations, but was withdrawn on an undertaking by the bankers. Yes, gentlemen's agreement, that they would seek permission from the Treasury for any future amalgamations. Bank of England interests were thus protected and shielded from any foul winds emanating from monopolization in joint stock banking. Quigley notes that the dispersal of joint stock banks were as follows. 9 in Ireland, 8 in Scotland, 16 in England and Wales. He notes also that the combined deposits of these banks in 1933 were 2,500 million sterling, 1,773 million of which was in the Big Five, that is, the Midland, Lloyds, Barclays, Westminster and National Provincial. He suggests that competition was keen among the Big Five banks, but that all were nonetheless subject to the Bank of England via the instrument of the discount rate, interlocking directorships and indeed true tradition, ambition and prestige. So what then was the discount rate? Well, the discount rate can be summarized as follows. The discount rate is the interest rate for short-term money market instruments, like commercial paper and treasury bills. Commercial paper being unsecured short-term debt issued by a corporation, and treasury bills being money market instruments issued by governments as promissory notes, with guaranteed repayment at later dates. Quigley notes that in Britain, financial capitalism served to create the conditions for monopoly capitalism by insisting on orthodox deflationary policies, which eventually alienated industrialists from financiers. He notes also that monopoly capitalism finally scored victory over financial capitalism in 1931. He further observes that back in 1918, the Board of Trade had announced that Britain had 500 restrictive trade associations on the go, and that same year, the Federation of British Industry, the FBI no less, announced that its goals would be focused on the regulation of prices, the curtailment of competition, and the fostering of cooperation in technical matters, in politics and in publicity. The Federation of British Industry, he notes, also set their sights on the elimination of excess productive capacity, the restriction of entry of new firms, and the enforcement of minimum price regulations and production quotas. What a bully boy organisation, eh? With respect specifically to production quotas, Quigley further points out that a focus in this direction was steadily strengthening during the 9 years 1931 through 1940. Circa 1937, we see the heavy gang becoming involved in the fray, with the House of Lords acting as a Supreme Court, handing out a decision permitting the use of duress against outsiders in order to force compliance with restrictive economic agreements. Amazing stuff. Quigley goes on to characterise the apparent death throes of British financial capitalism by stating as follows. Financial capitalism, which was seen as having held the British economy in semi-depression, achieved a last great victory when financiers led by Montagu Norman and J.P. Morgan forced the resignation of the Labour government in 1931. However, monopoly capitalism in Britain aspired to make the banking system its servant rather than its hitherto master. Without question, financial capitalists, managing to get rid of the Labour government in 1931, was a key pivot point in British industrial economics, but may also be characterised as somewhat of an own goal. Why own goal? Well, the upshot of the financial capitalists' political stroke was that both Labour and industry were now united against the continuance of the bankers' economic policies of low prices and high unemployment. Quigley reveals that the absolute tipping point from the financial capitalism into monopoly capitalism came in the wake of the revolt of the British fleet at Invergordon, the latter being a strategic base for the Royal Navy in Scotland, which took place in September 15, 1931. The mutiny had a clear message: the economic policy of deflation must be ended. Part of the unravelling following the mutiny was a decision taken, I assume by Treasury, not to make any effort to defend the gold standard. So with gold gone and protective tariffs in, there ensued a joining of forces between Labour and monopolist capital in efforts to raise both wages and profits. Quigley goes on to observe that under this new monopolistic arrangement, old monopolies increased in strength and new monopolies were actually formed. The forcing of restrictive practices both on members of the various organisations involved and also upon outsiders became the norm. Incredibly, with respect to British business circles, productive capacity in their own lines were bought up and destroyed. In some cases, statute law was evoked, but in most, they were simply private ventures. And all the while, surprise, surprise, government made no real effort to protect consumers. Quigley quotes Herman Levy, 1881-1949, a British economist, as having observed, "Today, Britain is the only highly industrialized country in the world where no attempt has been made to restrict the domination of quasi-monopolistic associations in industry and trade." Quigley goes on to observe that yes, the British government did not accept the suggestion by Lord Melchett of the Federation of British Industry that cartels and trade associations should be made compulsory, but such free rein was given by government that enforcing compulsion was simply not necessary. Why? Because refusing to adopt the restrictive practices would simply ensure that your business would be ruined, the latter process being guaranteed via a combination of social pressures and economic duress. So what then was the outcome of all of this? Well, as a result of the prevailing regulatory regime, inefficiency, high prices and low output became the norm, in the face of which one dare not question or speak out, as to do so would incur the wrath of labelling as being socially unacceptable or even of being a traitor to Britain. Quigley notes that a significant descending voice of the era seems to have been The Economist, that is the magazine which typically delivers content for high-profile individuals, organisations and entrepreneurs, which on the 8th of January 1944 stated, "Too few British businessmen are trying to compete. In these days, to say that a firm has so increased its efficiency that it can sell at low prices is not to give praise for initiative and enterprise, but to criticise it for breaking the rules of fair trading and for indulging in the ultimate sin of cutthroat competition." Quigley then goes on to provide two examples of the impact of restrictive practice regulation within the British economy as follows. Coal mines. Under the Coal Mines Act of 1930, production quotas were allocated to each colliery, and a requirement was laid down for fixing minimum prices. Shipbuilding. The National Shipbuilders Association, which had been established also in 1930, began buying up and destroying shipyards. This destruction was financed by funds from a £1 million bond issue, which was paid for via a 1% levy on construction contracts. Incredibly, the industry was being called upon to pay for its own destruction. So, by 1934, one quarter of Britain's shipbuilding capacity had been eliminated. And the Millers Mutual Association, which had been set up in the 1920s, totally suppressed competition among its members, and set up a purchase finance company to buy up and destroy flour mills. To me, all of this was truly incredible stuff, especially when one considers that, but 5 years later, Britain was going to find itself embroiled in yet another world war. So how damaging, then, was the cumulative impact of the economic policies followed by Britain during the mid to late 20th century? And on, the negative impact of Britain's economic policies of the mid to late 20th century went. For example, the Lancashire Cotton Corporation acquired 10 million spindles in just 1 year, 1936 to 37, and went on to scrap at least 5 million of them. Quigley goes on to point out that despite an international crisis, economic restrictive actions continued in Britain right up to May 1940. However, Churchill's war-related mobilisation brought fuller utilisation of resources in Britain than elsewhere. Quigley notes that financial capitalism was well and truly defeated in Britain between the late 1930s and the mid-1940s. This by dint of full employment, which itself was a key and critical element within the Churchillian war economy. Quigley further observes that in post-World War II context, entrenched political ideologies and likewise entrenched economic ideologies hampered Britain's economic future. For example, the Labour Party in government, 1945 to 51 under Clement Attlee, represented the interests of the labour unions and more remotely the interests of consumers, while in contrast, the Conservative Party in government post 1951 under Churchill, Eden, Macmillan and Douglas Hume represented the propertied class and still continued to show strong banking influence. Quigley nonetheless points out that a kind of balance existed in which a welfare state was established, but at the cost of slow inflation and indeed the slack use of resources. It would appear that consumption and enjoyment rather than production were the hallmarks of the British economy, even under the Conservatives. Efforts were instead focused on supporting the value of the pound on foreign exchanges rather than productive investment. Well, at this juncture, I would briefly pause to toss the following question into our review mix. Would it be surprising that after 6 years of catastrophic war, the British people on a rebound would gravitate towards consumption and enjoyment, even for a limited period of time? Personally, I don't think that such a relatively immediate post-war economic reaction would be in any way surprising. And now, via the following observation, we see Quigley starting to identify the beginnings of systemic change in Britain's economic reality. He records that the middle class, that is, the professional and educated groups, were not represented by either the Conservative Party or the Labour Party. Yes, there was a Liberal Party, but voters were very wary of the concept of coalition and of any prospective irresponsible government, which the inclusion of such within any political formula might produce. So what then did the new disruptive force look like? Well, it looked like managers, scientists, professional men, and imaginative parvenu entrepreneurs, the latter being persons of humble origin who have gained wealth, influence and or celebrity. Such a cohort began to cause serious erosion within a very long-established British class structure. The emergent nouveau riche, as they may be identified, tended to ignore the older upper crust, while at the same time being significantly resentful of even their existence. So, Quigley concludes, and this is to a degree my take, this new rich lot, an amorphous, vigorous group, which apparently had no common outlook, by dint of its ever-increasing numbers began to significantly blur the outline of the older class. Moreover, Quigley points out that the adoption of a BBC accent made it even more difficult to identify class, education, and the geographic origin of speakers. In addition to the aforementioned difficulties was the fact of the existence of an improved appearance and health in ordinary Englishmen, by virtue of better living standards and, of course, the existence of the National Health Service. Interesting to note that clothing, relative to men only, remained the one characteristic which might be used to differentiate class. Women, on the other hand, Quigley asserts, were influenced by style magazines and cinema, tended towards wearing similar dresses, similar cosmetics, and presenting themselves with similar hairstyles. Looking back towards the economy, Quigley asserts that Britain's economy was made up of blocks of dynamic interest groups, all of which impacted upon economic policies. Broadly speaking, there existed a tripartite construct comprising of 1. Consumer living standards, 2. Investment needs, and 3. Government expenditure, the latter mostly being on defence. Under the model of monopolism, the British economy had seen banking pushed to the background in favour of governmental interests as handed down via the Treasury. Quigley asserts that the weakening of the power of the banks in Britain had not occurred through laws, but instead had occurred through a shift in direction of investment funds, which increasingly had bypassed the banks. By way of examples, he references larger industrial enterprises such as British Imperial Chemicals and Shell Oil, which he states were largely self-financing, with this having been achieved on foot of monopolization through cartels, patent controls, or the control of scarce resources. In the brave new world of British monopolistic economics, Quigley reveals that finance generally came from government and from public authorities. For example, the National Coal Board, which produced £17 million per year in new money seeking investment. Furthermore, in 1961, the insurance companies provided £1.5 million per day in seeking investment. The largest of which, he records, was Prudential, which poured £2 million per week, much of which headed into industrial shares. And so, in 1953, the Conservative Party denationalised the steel industry, in effect reversing a Labour government's move of 1948. Much of the associated shares were bought up by insurance companies. Quigley contends that the enormous funds involved created a great danger, that the handful of men who handled the investment of such funds could become a centralised power in British economic life. Prescience of 58 years ago, and not just for Britain. Today, but in global context, what do we have? We have the cold and dark influence of 4 enormous funds impacting our day-to-day lives, namely BlackRock, Charles Schwab, State Street, and Fidelity Investments. Look them up. With a little condescension, in my humble opinion, Quigley goes on to point out that other sources of funds, this time from the lower classes, could be found within post office savings. He claims that the lower class British look upon banks with suspicion. I say, how very perceptive of them, seeing banks as alien upper-class institutions, and as such, the ordinary British Joes and Janes preferred to place their savings somewhere else. Interesting to note that the postal savings of over 6,000 million were about the same size as the deposits of all of the 7 joint stock banks, the latter being institutions owned and controlled by shareholders. Next up in Quigley's consideration were the pension funds, which reached a total of around £2,000 million by the end of 1960, and were increasing at the rate of £150 million per year. His attention was next turned towards what he describes as the other 2 non-banking innovations, which he records as building societies, or buildings and loans in US context, and the hire purchase associations, that is, the installment buying organisations, or the Never Never, as the latter was once referred to in Ireland. Never short of the wee bit of condescension, Quigley goes on to suggest that together, that is, the building societies and the installment buying organisations, contributed to wiping away of much of the dinginess of English lower class life. Looking back towards the banks, Quigley suggests that one consequence of the diminishing control of the banks was that the traditional method of controlling consumption and investment, that is, the use of charges in bank rates, had become decreasingly effective. The beneficiary in all of this, Quigley implies, was government, through increasing control. But such came at the cost of a dampening down movement in the business cycle. Government exercised controls through insisting on higher deposits on installment buying and on higher carrying charges. He notes the winds of change arriving for Britain's economy and states that Britain's formerly independent control of its economy began to come under increasing uncontrollable influence from outside, for example, from the United States and from the European Common Market, and indeed international agency pressures such as from the International Monetary Fund. he finalizes his review of Great Britain by concluding that what had developed was a complex and increasingly feudalized social welfare economy in which managers, rather than owners, shared power within a complicated dynamic system whose chief features are still largely unknown, even to serious students. End of the review of Great Britain. And there's more, much more. Why not check out the Alan Watt CCTM channel on YouTube, where Melissa regularly presents Redux material from the late great Alan Watt, and in addition presents her own ever-interesting real history programs. In addition, also on YouTube, you have the very excellent Hayes Reviews channel, where you can enjoy full online readings and genial host interactions relative to a huge range of truly significant books. Books which reveal truth relative to history from the very pens of movers and shakers of bygone eras. They may be gone, but to this day, we are living a dark legacy of their anti-human plans and schemes, which are being actualized by their intergenerational ideological devotees and collaborators. I hope you have found the information which was presented here to have been both interesting and indeed educational. Thank you for your time and attention, and please do check out the other 7 podcasts in this mini-series.